Sir Thomas, please. Jerry Langford.
What happened?
They hung up.
Call them again. Why did they hang up?
Probably thought it was a gag. We get that all the time.
Well, I find that strange, you know. But it's typical. Because that's the way they treat even you. Because I'll let you in on a little secret. That's the way they treated me. And now look where we are.
Bert Thomas.
Audrey, this is Jerry Langford. Get Bert Thomas on the phone, and quickly.
Martino, I know it's you, and I'm much too busy for fun and games today. Goodbye.
Did you hear what I said? This is Jerry Langford. Now get Bert Thomas, and I'm not kidding. It's not a gag. It's serious. Now move it.
For 7 minutes. Why don't we have somebody else?
Like what?
Well, somebody.
It's Mr. Langford. He says it's urgent.
Tell him I'll call him back. I'm busy. It's that Martino kid, the impressionist.
Okay.
Will you do what I tell you? And do it quick.
I got him talking. I'm sorry, Mr. Thomas. He absolutely insists on talking to you. I cannot get rid of him.
Okay, I'll take it. Martino, you know better than to...
Bert, I said this is Jerry. Jerry Langford. And I'm in deep trouble. Now, you best pay attention.
Yeah, I am listening. Now, wait a minute. I want to ask you something. Oh, what do we call our second cameraman?
We call our second cameraman Helen Keller. His favorite color is plaid.
Helen Keller, plaid, what is that?
When someone does an impression of me on the phone, the only way they're going to know it's really me is by that clue.
If
I didn't know the name that we called him, then he would know it's not me.
Say no more, I understand.
Now listen, Bert. Listen carefully. I have a gun at my head. If a man who identifies himself as the king, cards upside down, is not allowed to be the first guest on, you got a blank card. Hold on, Bert.
It's Adam Chartoff back. It's only been a couple of days I'm back. It's Monday, the 21st of August, 2017. This is episode number 422 of the podcast. Putting up some extra episodes in the coming weeks. The reason I'm doing this is because I have wonderful interviews and conversations to share with you. And I want to put them out into the world, into the universe. So there'll be some extra episodes going into the fall through September. There's going to be lots of extra guests and old friends coming on the podcast. And a secondary reason is because, as I mentioned in a kind of soft announcement, not the hard announcement, but a soft announcement, is I'm going to be doing a crowdsourced campaign this month, asking you for the first time ever in all the years I've been doing this show, over 420 episodes plus, I've never asked for a dime. I really haven't. And now I'm going to ask for you to kick back a little or as much as you want to give. Any amount really matters. Not really announcing it. Mind you, this was a soft announcement, so we're just going to put the pin in that for the moment because it is, as I said, 21st of the month. We have another 10 days yet until I officially launch this thing. But let's say Wednesday night, I'm going to, my old friend, Owner Tukel, who's one of the oldest friends of this podcast. He's been on here 8 times. We're going to shoot a pitch video. And then gathering all my rewards together. And I'm just going to let you know, the reason I'm doing it is because, as you know, for years now, I've been championing independent filmmakers and independent films. Now the idea is to expand, broaden the reach, be able to even be more effective in this independent film world. I'm just going to ask you to be aware of it, to start thinking about it, consider. It would mean a lot to me. So let's get on with a really great episode. tonight, Monday, the 21st of August through the 27th of August. That's going through next weekend. The Brooklyn Comedy Festival will be taking place in and around Williamsburg, I believe, mostly. Go to the website, though, check out the specifics about that. Part of the comedy festival, which has, I think, been going on for at least 7 years. I'm not completely sure of all my details with the comedy festival. You know, I'm a film guy. I'm not necessarily a comedy guy. But having said that, this is the second year where the Brooklyn Comedy Festival is going to have something called the Brooklyn Comedy Film Festival. So, lady, the Brooklyn Comedy Film Festival is the result of a partnership with the Brooklyn Comedy Festival and Kickstarter. Together, they have curated the Brooklyn Comedy Film Festival, and which will take, again, take place from the 21st through the 27th at the Nighthawk Cinema. Each night at 7:30, there'll be a different comedy film. Tonight with Sex House, which is a, I guess, adapted from a web series. I caught some of the episodes. It is unbelievably funny. You can go to YouTube and look up Sex House, and I believe this is a variation on this really funny web series based on reality TV shows. Then on Tuesday, August 22nd, Snowy Bing Bongs, which is a film I saw at BAM Cinema Fest a couple of months ago. It's basically a comedy sketch movie. Snowy Bing Bongs is the, I guess you could call the character name for the Cocoon Central Dance Team. It's as though they were a character in a movie, but instead of being called the Cocoon Central Dance Team, they're called Snowy Bing Bongs. Then Village People on Wednesday the 23rd, then on the 24th, Neighborhood Food Drive is the name of the film. There's going to be a shorts program over the weekend and during the afternoon with a brunch included, I believe, all at the Nighthawk Cinema on Metropolitan Avenue in Williamsburg. Check out the Nighthawk Cinema website or check out Kickstarter's website or check out Brooklyn Comedy Festival's website for more details, tickets, etc. But get down there. These films are really funny. And I'm sure there's going to be lots of great appearances and panels and that type of thing. To talk further about it, in a couple of minutes, we're bringing on the comedy lead at Kickstarter. His name is Taylor Moore. First time on the show, Taylor Moore. Hopefully the first of many visits coming up in just a minute. And then, because I love you so much, right now you can buy tickets for the movie Marjorie Prime. It stars John Hamm, Gina Davis, Tim Robbins, and the lovely Lois Smith. On this episode, filmmaker of Marjorie Prime, Michael Almereyda, very excited about this, and actress Lois Smith, coming up in just a little bit. And they're going to talk about their movie, Marjorie Prime, which is currently in theaters. And that's another reason why, by the way, that I wanted to get this episode up. But first, let's get into a conversation with Kickstarter comedy lead Taylor Moore here on FilmWax Radio.
You and John Borman, which was like,
oh my gosh,
a delight.
Oh, I did shoot a few seconds of that. You know, it's so frustrating because if I had my way, I would be with somebody, or I'd like to have somebody with me assisting me. And sometimes I do, like I have an intern this summer, but most of the time I go in by myself or I'll invite somebody over like this. And it's nice to get the clips, you know. I don't have to videotape the whole thing. And most people are prepared for audio-only circumstances. Mm-hmm. So it would be unfair to kind of sabotage them by bringing in the film crew, you know. And I do believe you do achieve something special by not bringing in because it automatically there's like an intimacy that's created. But the clip like you saw with John Borman, you know, it's just a great little way to promote the podcast. And I'm also aware on another level that a lot of people don't listen to the podcast at all or just pop in and out when, you know, something looks interesting to them. So, you know, I don't have the kind of listenership that I think other shows might where they just, you know, it's every episode. My show is kind of different in the sense that it's all about the guest, you know, so it makes sense that people would pop in and out. So that's just the nature of what I do.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. You go ahead.
Oh, so I was just going to say, it caught my eye because I love John Borman
much. What's your favorite part?
I am a big defender of Zardoz.
Zardoz.
I think Zardoz is a misunderstood, great.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a fiasco, but it's a lovable and endearing fiasco.
Oh, yeah. And if, Ken, if you are of the right state of mind, it could be just the right kind of movie to watch one night with friends in the right circumstances. Zardoz, I know it's a mind trip. It's like, how did that happen? How does Sean Connery end up in this? And
yeah, you know. it's. I love those movies where you're like, well, how? What was the conversation leading up to this? Who critiqued what parts? How did this come out of the sausage factory? It's a miracle.
It's also interesting because you're getting the John Borman, the 80-year-old John Borman. You know, you're not getting the 40 or 35-year-old John Borman who might have been a very different guy. You know, I get sometimes, like I also had on years ago, about 2 or 3 years ago, Robert Downey Sr., you know, and he was a very paternal, warm, retiring, intelligent, funny, but you know, he was like, he's an old man. And, but he was a punk. He was a scroungy punk years ago. He was an alcoholic and a drug addict. And, you know, you were like, where is that person? You know, you don't see it. It's very interesting. So I don't think John Borman was that, but he was certainly a lot more like, you know, now he's an older English gentleman, you know.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But he made Zardoz.
Mellowed out.
Right.
I can't think of the word. You know, just a lot more perspective, much calmer about some things.
Yeah.
You know. But yeah, you're definitely not the same guy that made Zardoz.
Right. But I love that catalog he made because it's so diverse of subject matter and tone. Like, his films are just all over, you know? He's made a few of my favorites along the way, so.
Oh, so cool. Oh, yeah, I'm glad that's the bit I got to catch.
What a great guest, you know? So, but give it a listen. Give that show a listen when you get a minute after maybe the festival.
Yes.
Because I'm sure you're... Taylor Moore, who's the guest today, is you're under the employ of Kickstarter.
I am.
And you're the lead, or whatever they're going to call it. You're for comedy, mm-hmm. right? Yucks.
Yes, I'm the Obergriffen Fuhrer for Yucks.
For Yucks.
I'm the comedy.
Let's shy from the Germanic fascistic expressions just for the moment.
Oh, I've been traveling. I haven't been keeping up with current events. Okay. Anything recently happened that I should know about?
I'm not a newspaper reader, so and so. The thing at hand right now, the topic at hand, is the Brooklyn Comedy Festival, which is now going into its, 60th season. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, you're right. That is correct.
How many years has it been going on? This is
the Brooklyn Comedy Festival, the larger mothership entity. This is
this is like a micro version.
The whole festival is a 6 year, but they've never had a film program, and last year was the first year for film.
I'm sorry, you're right. I didn't stipulate. I just called it the Brooklyn Comedy Festival. This is the Brooklyn Comedy Film Festival.
Well, it's all the same thing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is the comedy festival that's going on the last week of or currently anyway? Right.
It starts Monday. Right, currently.
As people are hearing us, it is the 21st.
Oh, you're the Doc Brown to my Marty. This is mind bending.
Right.
Let me tell you something. You know something, Marty?
Sorry, I have to pull out my impression.
That's great.
I started with, you know, something, Alex.
I started, you know, with Taxi. Taxi, right? It was Taxi.
Yeah, it was Taxi.
I try not to mistake it with Taxi Driver. I always try to. It's like some sort of tick or something where I call Taxi Driver with Robert De Niro, Taxi. But no, so I mastered doing Christopher Lloyd. I don't know how. It just, you know, just one of those impressions I can pull out of my...
It's one of the great impressions to have.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah.
Everybody loves Christopher Lloyd. The Brooklyn Comedy Film Festival, though, at Kickstarter present the Brooklyn Comedy Film Festival. So you are partnering with... The Kickstarter, I should say, is partnering with the Brooklyn Comedy Festival.
Right. I met the folks that run the Comedy Festival. I met them last year, and we really hit it off. I think they do a really great job. And so we were like, what can we do to, like, help?
Yeah. Where is the Comedy Festival?
All over Brooklyn.
Okay, so, like, let's say...
Mostly up around Williamsburg.
Got it. We have a real Brooklyn Comedy Film Festival the last 6 years, and now there is a section devoted to comedy films.
Yeah, and it comes from last year. There's an incredible scene of people that are making really remarkable, fun, brilliant stuff. I think pushing way beyond their weight. They were getting into small festivals here and there, but no one was really like saying, we're going to take a stand and like make sure people see this.
Just to get into the nitty-gritty of what we're talking about, I mean, there is a specific type of film that's being made by people of the comedy universe, or you know, in our from this area, but or not, that these are the films of that kind of community. It's not just so you know, it's not just a independent filmmaker necessarily who made a funny movie, but these are films based around the community of comedy too. Like Snowy Bing Bongs, for instance, who just happens to be like a friend of mine or in it, and so. That is, you know, they're a comedy troupe. They're a dance comedy troupe, but they're a comedy troupe.
Absolutely. The first time I met Cocoon Central Dance Team, which is the comedy group that is going under the name Snowy Bing Bongs as characters in the film, it's as complicated as any Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, it's a good way of explaining it.
I think I like first saw them perform in a basement in the East Village.
Yeah.
You know, six or seven years ago. And I think, I don't even know if they had their name or the current, none of the current shtick or anything. But yeah, they've been doing comedy for a long time. And almost everything in the festival comes from people who maybe are even closer to the comedy scene than they are like the capital F filmmakers.
Yes, and that's what I'm saying. So these films don't, but they don't end up in the typical indie film festival because of the nature that they're so. Yeah. So that's why this should exist.
Yeah, and when they do end up in those festivals, I don't think they do as well as they ought
to. It's hard to market that. Mm-hmm. Snowy Bing Bongs, for instance, was in Cinema Fest. I was in a nice crowded theater when I saw it at BAM Cinema Fest. You know, so it was a lovely thing. But almost as entertaining was the Q&A afterwards because the girls, of course, were enjoying that moment.
They're incredible people.
Yeah.
They are wonderful.
Tally is an old friend of mine. I you know, I've known her, but my way to knowing Tally wasn't through her comedy or dance, but it was through independent film acting that she's done over the years.
Oh, yeah. You know? Yeah, she's extraordinary.
Yeah, I love
And now
her.
They've made this thing that's, it's like the actual film itself is, what, like 40, 41 minutes long?
Right, it's very
short. Like, it is not in a format that fits on any traditional medium.
Right. Nor festivals, typically.
Yeah.
Because most festivals like that 80 to 90 minute period of the running time. No. Taylor, let's put a pin in this for just a second or two. We'll come right back to the Comedy Film Festival, but I want to know your background. I want to know you. How long have you been at Kickstarter?
Oh, I've been at Kickstarter for 4 years.
Okay. And now, I mean, this is not going to be an enormous amount of interest to the average listener, that comedy has fallen under the rubric for some reason of film at Kickstarter, right? Mm-hmm. It's part of.
Sort
Kinda?
Of. So this is weird.
Why?
And this is a problem, and, you know, buckle up, because if you're not interested now, it's only going to get worse in the next 30
seconds.
Now
I have to do my Betty Davis impression? Is that the what you're trying to...
Kids today can't get enough of your Betty Davis impression.
I can't do it.
The categories at Kickstarter are based on, it's games, video games, tabletop games, tech and design, film, documentary feature, all this stuff.
Okay.
There are mediums, right?
Sure.
Whereas comedy is a genre. The thing about comedy is that, just like we were saying earlier, someone who's in the comedy world will make a movie, and then they won't call themselves a filmmaker. They'll still consider themselves a comedy person or a comedian. They'll write a book, and they don't consider themselves an author. Yeah. They still think of themselves as a comedy person. They move within those circles, and the comedy industry, you know, has issues and problems and structures and networks and concerns and economies that other industries don't. So even though the, you know, comedy can exist in all other categories, it does seem to be a little hidden world all on its own.
Hmm. Interesting. And yet there is just more comedy than ever.
Yeah, the internet. I mean, what are you going to do?
The internet.
It's perfect.
Right. It's been this great vehicle. And, I mean, and just, and TV. I mean, Netflix is like as many comedy specials as there are.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's incredible. Kind of, and there's more coming. I mean, there's other independent production companies and other production companies that are going to be making way more than Netflix.
Yeah. There should be a cable station devoted to comedy. Anyway,
I know Canada has one. I only hope that one day America can too.
Yeah, or an award show, something. I don't know. It's so sad. Well, we mentioned one film, Snowy Bing Bongs, which again, I do know the some of the folks in there, and I just want to mention. And I'm actually working on getting the filmmakers onto FilmWax Radio.
Oh yeah, you got
it. And I've talked to them about it. I mean, which is Rachel Wolter and Alex Fisher. Mm-hmm. And I would love to bring on the dancers, the girls, too.
Oh, yeah.
But if I only get one, it's going to be Tally, just because I have this...
They're hard to schedule. They're blowing up.
Oh, dear. I better do something. Sorry, I can get John Borman, but I can't get Tally Madell. That's going to be the way it is.
Yep.
But, you know. All right, let's talk about a couple of the other films, though. How many films? There's not a ton of them, right?
It's small. It's like
four
titles? No, it's small. And that's by design. Or? Absolutely.
Four?
Or five. Or...
Well, there's four weeknight screenings.
And then there's shorts, too.
And then the shorts program is on the weekend, Saturday and Sunday.
Okay, yeah. So do we want to discuss... well, we could at least mention some of the other films.
Yeah, we definitely should. Like, maybe one of the weirdest things we're doing is Monday night. Monday night, we're screening a new cut of Sex House. Sex House was a web series that was produced and released by The Onion.
Oh. It's a satire of like Big Brother and these other
the real world,
but people stuck in a house together where all sorts of provocation ensues.
Right. The premise is that these six people are going to be locked in this house, and we, the audience, are going to watch them have sex.
So it cuts right to the chase, essentially.
One of the at The Onion at its peak, I think, was the great Chase Cutter tour.
Yeah.
I mean, not only, you know, The Onion at its peak was high art, both, you know, literature and comedy. And I think that of all the videos that The Onion made, I think this series, this project, maybe represents it at its best. Uh-huh. And I think Sex House is like one of the great works of satire of our current age.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you're looking at me funny. I will not back down.
Okay.
I will not back down.
You may win this round, Taylor, but Sex House.
Yeah.
It's a web exclusive Pitch Black satire. Oh, it says right there.
Mm-hmm.
About America's reality show driven culture. Yeah, our obsession with watching lean, young, hard bodies in various forms of undress
and sexual coitus. It goes so far beyond the sex thing. And that's I'll tell you a little bit of the background of it. During the time at The Onion, there was this little cabal of writers and producers that met and formed there and kind of had their own little skunk works within the company, and they're the ones who made Sex House. And they would later go on to make a lot of other really funny stuff that comedy nerds might know. Smart Pipe. It eventually became known as like Wild Aggressive Dog, is this group. And the show starts off as the parody of this like sex-obsessed, horribly debauched, you know, voyeuristic culture. But it very, very quickly becomes... You know, like, this is you, society, in the best way possible. Uh-huh. I mean, the perspective is very much like people trapped by their worst impulses in this, like, inescapable, constantly, like, dying and roasting, like, post-capitalist nightmare world. And you got to see it. I can't wait to watch it.
I wish there was a way I could see it. Oh, wait. So that's going to be Monday. That's going to be It's Monday night, which is going to be. Let's see. That's this coming. So it's tonight because I'm going to post this Monday. So then we'll have to promote the crap out of Sex House. No, I'm really looking forward to it, and it's there'll be a panel discussion afterwards.
Yeah, we've got most of Wild Aggressive Dog in the theater.
Okay, that's the troupe that evolved from the creator, this Onion like comedy writers' room or whatever you want to call it. Whatever.
Yeah, these are the same guys that wrote Lake Dredge Appraisal and Onion Talks and Porking Across America.
I'm missing too much. I'm not scheduling my time.
Well, a lot of the stuff was missed. I mean, that's just the way it was. I mean, you had some of the best comedy writers working in English language, and they were putting stuff out on the Onion's like B-list website.
Yeah.
I don't mean that it was a bad website. I mean, like, just it wasn't given the attention that it comes close to deserving.
I spend a lot of my comedy time these days, not so surprisingly, listening to comedian podcasts, but not just ones that are just completely comedy driven. They're actually great conversations. You know, they're funny, and they're often But you know, it's kind of where I've been focusing my comedy attention.
Oh, at most people, I think. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
These days.
And then Tuesday, as we mentioned, the Snowy Bing Bongs will be. These are, by the way, I neglected to mention, going to all take place at the Nighthawk in Williamsburg, which, of course, as we all know, is on it's right by Kent.
It's on Metropolitan, I believe.
Metropolitan, right by Kent. Anyway, you know where.
You know, everybody knows
Nighthawk. If you're listening to this show, you know where Nighthawk is. But you know, do you know, as a sidebar, not to get off topic, but there's going to be a second Nighthawk. Do you know that?
I'm well aware, very close to where we are now.
Exactly, just a few blocks away. Nighthawk has bought the Pavilion Theater. So, I don't know, just leave some of that craziness behind. I hope they do. No, they're going to have to, like... I guess I heard there was a kitchen already in there. I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, who knows?
I was there.
Probably like six sub-basements, some sort of military installation. You know, a disappointments room in the attic where the ghosts of all the orphans live.
Yeah, there's an old prison in the one level even further down, and you just keep going further down. It's like Dante's Infernos below the Pavilion Theater.
You can make it past the bed bugs.
In Sunny
Park. You can find some real fun stuff.
I forgot about that. Well, my kid is now 13, and he, you know, I've been in and out of the slope for many years, but he, maybe I took him there twice, maybe three times. And I think it was that post-bed bug period, but it's a nightmare. Anyway, so God
well,
bless.
Not anymore.
It's about to open, right?
The Nighthawk people are so great.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know. I think it's a ways off from opening, but
okay.
Holy smokes.
I don't know. We'll keep in touch, of course, with that, because I think that's of interest. To get back to, so it will be at the Nighthawk, the one in Williamsburg, the only mm-hmm. one. And the third night, which will be Wednesday, is a screening of, well, I popped over to, let me see this, Paul Briganti's Village People. A road trip flick that follows one man's last-ditch effort to save his marriage, joined by his two eager brother-in-law on their way to Nicaragua's Mercado Viage, a hipster resort for American tourists. Who's Paul Briganti?
Right, exactly.
That's the question.
Directed by Paul Briganti, written by Paul Briganti and Dan Schoenbrunn. And
Dan is a friend
yeah,
of mine.
Right, exactly, right?
Also comes from Kickstarter.
Yeah, it comes from Kickstarter and IFP. I mean, these are people who have been in the local film scene for a long, long time, working their asses off. And this is their first feature. You know, Paul's like a classic bootstraps director story. He just started super small into his own production company, and then tons of stuff with College Humor and Big Breakfast. And he helmed the pilot episode of Adam Ruins Everything. And this is their first feature. And it's just this super sweet, really funny road comedy. It's fantastic. And it was shot on location, which is one of the reasons I love it. Like, it's a lot of people would not have the guts or the imagination to, or the the fun-finding sensibilities that these guys have to be able to do that, and it's just awesome to see.
Oh, God, it sounds great.
Sure. Yeah, I'll send you links to everything, and there's still tickets available.
Off tape, as they say. You got to listen. I got to put some guy on your radar who's an older guy, but he does this podcast. Now each episode, he does it twice a week, is 5 hours long because he's gone completely political, but he still talks. I mean, he's still hysterical, and he brings on the best comedians. He's a comedy writer. He wrote Triumph, the Insult Dog, Comet Dog, the sock puppet.
Yeah, of course. Robert Smigel.
Smigel.
Yes.
But anyway, Dave Feldman, we should definitely try to dip into some of his shows, because he does this great thing, especially there's another comedian who does the every year. He does the state of the industry speech.
I just saw him up in Montreal.
Yeah. Right.
Andy Kindler.
So whenever he has Kindler, they do these incredible, they're really close friends, and they do these wonderful routines. And one is, where are we off tape now? And then they'll say the most, just offensive shit. We're off tape, right? Yes, we're off tape. So every time they start a sentence, you go, we're off tape, right? And then they see something else. It's beautiful. Go. So try to look up.
Is this their new podcast, Mind Spiral?
No.
Okay.
No. Thought Spiral, I think it's called.
Thought Spiral,
Yeah. No, that's separate with that. With Elvis, what's his name?
Elvis
Adam
Mitchell?
No, it's not Elvis Mitchell. He's a film critic, but it's J. Elvis Weinstein.
Yes. Oh, God. He has so many.
The only reason I remember it is because his name was intentionally Jew. It's his acronym is Jew. So it's J.
Is that
Elvis
what the J stands
Weinstein.
For?
Yeah. But that's a good show, too. Yeah. I mean, Kindler is great, but he's even better when he's a guest on David Feldman's show. Mm. So I'm just putting that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll check it out.
We're gonna it's gonna be all about the festival. Don't worry. But I just feel like I gotta share some of this with you, because I finally found a comedy guy, and I'm a film guy, right? But I'm a closet comedy guy.
Everyone is. It's like music.
Here's my impression of
entertainment.
Andy Kindler. Ready?
Yeah.
You know something, David?
It's right on.
I'll never forget when Andy Kindler took me back in time so I could have sex with my mother.
Oh my God, that's beautiful.
Oh, it was great. You know, he's really neurotic, but he's also very tender in a way.
Indeed. Thursday night. It says here, Kickstarter comedy lead Taylor Moore right there. Thursday night, Jersey Roses. I love that name, Jersey Rose. I just feel like he changed his last name, but I'm not going to dwell on that. Jersey Rose's Neighborhood Food Drive is a film where hilarity ensues, again, ensues being the operative expression today, when a group of awful idiots fail at throwing a party over and over. Explain.
All right.
Mansplain
this
it.
This is... well, hopefully I'll just explain it. Yeah, I don't. Right. I don't we don't have don't to gender I mean. My explanation. this is, gosh, it's like picking a favorite child, except it's easy. I think this might be my favorite thing in the festival.
Oh, okay.
And I know I shouldn't say that, but you got to see this movie.
Okay.
There is a awful trend in mainstream comedy features uh-huh. these days. They are visually uninteresting. The performances are phoned in or by the numbers. I mean, it's, even when a movie has a pretty great jokes, it's not fun to look at, and it's just generally kind of boring when the joke's not happening on screen. Not all of them, but I do think that we've sort of lost our way from the late 20th century mm-hmm. Run on comedy features. Jersey Rose does not have any of those problems. This movie is...
So it's inspired you.
God, I love it so much. This is one when I was screening films for acceptance to the festival, I stood up off my couch and was like yelling for my wife to run upstairs and like see this. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful.
Wow.
The performances are so like they're almost hypnotically strange, but the characters are instantly recognizable and you instantly hate them. It is
oh, wow.
wonderful. So it's the story of these like hyper unaware bougie gentrifiers in Chicago that are opening up this very expensive little boutique restaurant in a economically devastated part of town. And, you know, tale as old as time. Mm-hmm. And they get some bad reviews because of it. The locals, you know,
yeah.
no one can afford this food. It's terrible. You're assholes.
Right.
And so their solution is, hey, let's do something nice for the community. Let's have a neighborhood food drive. And things go south from there. And the way things escalate and the way these horrible monsters deal with it is endless. I've watched it, I think, two times mm-hmm. since mm-hmm. the original screen just because I love it so much. And there's also the joy of like discovering a new director whose work you're clearly going to love forever. Jersey Rose just has this incredible voice and a great eye.
Surprising. I'm just not familiar with
it. Well, it's out of Chicago, and okay. he's only made one feature before.
Okay.
And Neighborhood Food Drive was at Slam Dance and I think a few other festivals that were further away. But this is the New York premiere.
Okay. Yeah, it's great to hear about these films. Again, the Brooklyn Comedy Film Festival, again, part of the Brooklyn Comedy Festival, takes place at the Nighthawk Cinema in Williamsburg from the 21st through the 27th as well. So mm-hmm. is it one film
Monday
event?
Monday through Sunday, except for Friday night.
Right. Oh, mm-hmm. Friday, you don't want to step on the toes. We're driving all of the business over to the comedy.
Right. Yeah,
the sure. live comedy stuff, right?
I might be doing some sort of secret ritual event in a basement somewhere, but it's not listed publicly.
Mm. And then I'm sorry, I did cut you off because there are shorts. On the weekend, I apologize.
And then on Saturday and Sunday we have a shorts program uh-huh. for brunch at Nighthawk, and they're really something this year.
Oh, great!
Yeah,
by a bunch of different people. I'll try to cut and paste that into that, and then we can go back to what's happening on Friday. There's some sort of
I can't talk publicly about what's happening.
Is there like a secret event? Or are you just joshing me?
No, there is a secret event, but it's okay. invite only.
Oh, I see.
It's not publicly listed.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Friday night, but there's other comedy events going
I'll
on.
I'll invite
Friday
you personally.
Well, I'll but come. But
can't take strangers.
No. Okay, but are you saying that there are? But there are also comedy events from the going on. As
part the festival. Oh, the festival goes on all week. It's every yeah. night. Yeah, and okay. it's huge. It's great.
I've had some comedians on the show, and those are some of my favorite segments. What kills me, I'm sharing this with you, but it was the like ultimate nightmare for a podcaster. There was just one day. But there was one day I did three podcast interviews. So Nick Kroll, I interviewed him, and it was wonderful. It was like I had seen the movie, and then he was a great guest. He was very friendly and funny. Yeah,
he's one of the great natural talents.
He's
out
just
there.
I've seen him on the street, incredible. And but this was we did this wonderful interview on the podcast, and then I went off and did a very esoteric documentary filmmaker, you know, which actually was for another podcast that I was doing it for, and I was getting paid for it. So and then I did a third one with a veteran. Funny man and impressionist.
Rodney Dangerfield.
No, Kevin Pollak. Rodney Dangerfield. Yes. No, Kevin Pollak, who he does a chat show, as he calls it. But he directed a documentary about comedians.
Hmm. Which one did he do?
He came out of Tribeca last year. Not this past Tribeca, but Tribeca 2016. It was called, like, Die Laughing. I don't remember what it's called. It was just like a bunch of many talking to about comedy with all these different comedians. I'll find it for you. And so I get home that night, and I have this because I take this around, right, when I'm not in a studio.
Oh, no. I know where this is going. Oh, no. Say it.
Yeah. One file, too corrupt. Mm. So I had to go through realizing that both the Nick Kroll and the Kevin Pollak were gone.
Oh, no.
The files just were corrupt. They didn't work out.
Oh, that's a nightmare.
The only reason I don't have I don't have scars on my wrists is because this third file, which I got paid for, was there. It made no sense. I used the same recorder, and I don't know what happened. But I will never have. And I and the girl that was kind of helping me out and interning for me, who took pictures of me and Kevin Pollak, right? And he did his Christopher Walken. No, he did his Christopher Fallas. No, but he did his Christopher Walken impression for me, you know, just because I asked him, you know, egged him on to do it. And he's always game, I guess. Unfortunate series of events. But yeah, I lost all that content. It was pretty frustrating to me.
I've been there before. I know how that feels.
Yeah. But, you know.
You get over it, but you never forget it entirely.
Yeah.
It burns.
It does. Just have a backup for the hell of it with your iPhone or whatever.
And there's no way around it. I mean, you think like, oh, our digital world is so precarious and fragile. And then you think of someone's suitcase falling open and their loose leaf manuscript flying into the breeze over the river.
Right.
It's like, you know, unless you're, well, you know, what, Gaius Populus and you're carving it into the marble edifice of some pantheon.
Yeah.
You're bunk.
To bring it back.
To sum up, sick transit Gloria.
The Comedy Film Festival will take place from Monday. As we said, Monday, is that the 21st? August 21st, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Today is Saturday, yes. So the Brooklyn Comedy Film Festival takes place Monday, August the 21st through the weekend, through, I guess, Sunday the 20th. Stop guessing, Chartoff. Through Sunday, August 27th at the Nighthawk Cinema in Williamsburg. Go to
bkcomedyfestival.com.
bkcomedyfestival.com.
Or nighthawkcinema.com.
Right, of course.
Yeah.
There you are. And also check into Kickstarter. See what kinds of – well, no, I'm going to just say see what kind of projects are going on under the comedy genre.
Oh, I will say this. You know, one thing we do, we don't require that a film be a Kickstarter project to be in the festival at all.
Okay.
Like, this is just about helping, this is like literally just about like helping people get this incredible work out in front of
these other works that just generally just don't, are harder to market in the typical indie film festivals that are out there. You don't see a lot of truly, I mean, Rick Alverson kind of helped a little bit or quite a bit maybe with his comedies because they were so dark and so deranged, like the comedy.
Oh, God, yes.
And the entertainment.
The entertainment absolutely destroyed me.
Yeah.
I was not okay.
Yeah. No. There is a podcast with him and for entertainment. I did a segment with Rick.
Oh, yeah?
Rick and...
Man. I wanted to get him to come into a Q&A and we screened the comedy.
I have a copy and I go back to it like once a year and watch it.
Yeah, I think like we might do it next year too because we couldn't make it happen this year, but I do think that is a real masterpiece that has not been given its fair due.
Yeah.
Maybe it's off topic, but I really want to talk about this for a second.
No, let's do it.
I do not understand why that movie is controversial. I think the way they made it is brilliant. I think it is extraordinary. I don't know why everyone involved isn't. I don't know. I will say this. I think that what Heidecker and Alverson saw in that character was such a specific strain of psychosis and pathology in people that, what was it, 5 years later, 8 years later? How long ago did that movie come out?
And yeah, about 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah, those people have taken over everything.
Right.
Like the brand of people that we saw in March in Charlottesville that are running the White House right now, that movie is about that kind
it's
of
true.
Person.
Right.
And like so it's almost like this horrible prophecy.
That's what I think about. When you think about the absence of a moral center of a where you're, you know, just would that be id driven or I don't know. But anyway, you're right. It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I think about this this president. But I listen, hey, no, look. When and if you do it, if you need a moderator for that Q&A, I'm there. And I promise
put your name on the list.
Yeah, exactly. I promise you'll have Christopher Lloyd on the stage.
Okay, please do any characters, Christopher Lloyd.
Yeah. Well, I'll be saying this is my impression of, you know, whomever, but it's always Christopher Lloyd, right?
Christopher Lloyd doing Betty Davis.
Now I have an image in my head. Thank you, Taylor Moore, for coming by, and I'm glad we were able to pull this off in such a short amount of time. It's terrific.
Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, I'll see you at the theater.
Okay, sounds good. Lost two icons of the comedy world. Speaking of comedy, we lost the great Dick Gregory, born Richard Claxton Gregory, in October of 1932, was a comedian, but probably as well known as being a civil rights activist. He was even arrested a bunch of times, went on a hunger strike. And after that hunger strike back in, I guess it was the 60s, he would periodically fast. It was like a health ritual for him. I believe at one point early on in his career, he may have had a weight problem, but for the last 50, 60 years of his life, he remained very, very slender based on this regiment that he created for himself. And but also remained a political activist to the very end. Was good friends with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and many other civil rights leaders, and was always highly respected in the world of comedy. Dick Gregory has died at the age of 84. What a great long life he had. The other, of course, as we mentioned already, Jerry Lewis. It's almost too incredible to think about. How do you vet Jerry Lewis? Again, one of those iconic people that have been there through your entire life, no matter how old you are. If you're on this planet right now, Jerry Lewis was there too. But do you know any of anybody else who's that old? Very few people. Maybe your great aunt who lives outside of Atlanta, Georgia. Maybe she's 104. Or maybe you have an uncle who lives in the Bayou area somewhere who's 101 years old. But Jerry Lewis, 91 years old, and has been around for my whole life, as well as my dad's whole life. Just incredible. What a career. He started as a child. His parents were vaudeville, I think in vaudeville. And he, was on the stage with them. He's had so many chapters, and he was brilliant. I'm not saying he wasn't a complicated figure. I'm not saying that he wasn't made a lot of duds. And there's so many wonderful chapters in that guy's life. I mean, if you think about it, there were so many different parts to this guy's life. I mean, you had, of course, the early part of life, of course, where he was working in the Borscht Belt with his parents, who were these vaudevillians. And then, as a young man, he teamed with Dean Martin. And the two, most people know that they were as big as the Beatles. They were enormous. They couldn't go anywhere without being overwhelmed with crowds of fans. They were enormous. They were a phenomenon. People couldn't contain themselves. And they were enormous for a 10-year stretch. And they made a bunch of comedies together that were all enormously successful. And then when they split up, finally, as most duos do, it's just not unnatural for most duos to stay together for, ever. He went solo. He had been offered the and signed the most lucrative Hollywood contract ever up to that time. It made him a very wealthy man. Sometime in, I don't know when they started exactly, but for over 30 years, he hosted the Labor Day telethon. And it's coming up Labor Day, first Labor Day without him being alive. He invented the telethon, essentially. But every year, 24 hours, wasn't it, where he would do the telethon? And he raised, according to statistics, I think over $2 billion for muscular dystrophy activism, MDA. Sort of has had a series of comebacks as anybody in the entertainment business who's been around for 60, 70 years should have. He's had a series of comebacks. One was, of course, when he came to Broadway about 25 years ago in Damn Yankees. Nobody probably thought, what? But he was like, in his 60s, maybe early 60s, and he came back and he did Damn Yankees on Broadway, and it was a huge hit for him. But my going back even further, my particular favorite comeback of Jerry Lewis, of course, was after making lots of duds, which he did. He started, you know, as I mentioned, after Dean Martin, he broke up their act, and he did solo movie. He made a bunch of highly successful movies. He had an ongoing partnership with the film director Frank Tashlin. With Tashlin or without, he ended up making a series of highly successful comedies, including, of course, 1963, the height being The Nutty Professor, but also including Who's Minding the Store and The Disorderly Orderly and a bunch of others. Most of the people my age, roughly around my age, The Linchpin, and it's not his best film, but it's the one that we kind of remember the most, is Cinderfella. That was pretty late. And then he just ended up going through a long stretch there, and he was hosting where he wasn't making very good movies, and he started hosting talk shows, and they were not very successful. He wasn't very good at hosting because, you know, the persona that he created as Jerry Lewis was not particularly likable. So if you go, and a lot of this is available on YouTube, you can go back and look at a lot of his early talk shows, his comeback talk show, and he's just not very good at it. He just doesn't really connect. I mean, not in the way like a Carson or a Letterman or any of those guys was able to do it. It wasn't his platform. But he came back in 1982 playing Jerry Langford in The King of Comedy, my opening clip for the show, one of my favorite movies of all time. Most recently, I had the director of a film called Max Rose. That was his last movie he made. And we had the director of that movie, we did had him on to talk about Jerry Lewis. I tried to get Jerry Lewis on the show, but I'm no Marc Maron, I guess. If you haven't heard that, you should go hear that. He almost didn't, Marc Maron decided to post this conversation. He almost didn't do it because of how difficult it was and how Jerry Lewis ended it abruptly after just about a half hour and walked out of the room. Not because he was offended by Maron, just because he was done. Hey, he was 90 years old. Who can really blame him? Anyway, so Jerry Lewis is dead at 91. Okay, let's get on to the next part of the podcast, which is, of course, Marjorie Prime, directed by Michael Almereyda. Go back and check out Michael Almereyda. He's one of our great filmmakers right now of dramatic films. Most people may know him when he first really hit the ground running with, I mean, most people first probably became aware of Michael with his adaptation of Hamlet, which was like an updated version, took place in New York City, contemporary setting with Ethan Hawke. And then most recently, he made a movie called Experimenter, which if you haven't seen, make a point of finding it and watch Experimenter, which was about the Milgram experiments and stars Peter Sarsgaard and Winona Ryder. It's a really, really good film. Jim Gaffigan is in it. It's terrific. Marjorie Prime is currently screening at the Quad Cinema here in New York City, and then it will be rolling out to other theaters around the country after this week. But it will still be at the Quad at least until this Thursday, August 24th. I urge you to go see it. The reviews have been stellar. Check them out. Don't go by my word. And again, the movie stars John Hamm, as well as Tim Robbins, Gina Davis, and Lois Smith. This episode, coming up right now, in just a couple of seconds, my conversation with Michael Almereyda and the actress Lois Smith, who is an actress who everybody knows because she's been around doing theater and film. Her first film was in, I think, 1959. It was with James Dean in East of Eden. A lot of other people remember playing Jack Nicholson's sister in Five Easy Pieces. And she's been working ever since nonstop. No kidding. Here it is right now. My conversation with the director, Michael Almereyda, and actress Lois Smith here on FilmWax Radio.
You're still too old for me.
We'll grow old together. I'll just do that a little sooner than you. After a while, it won't really matter. Hello. How are you?
Walter. There is someone in my mind. I'm trying to figure out who it is.
It's just me. It's just Walter.
I still don't like it.
What?
Dad's been dead for 15 years.
Does it bother you that your mother's talking to a computer program or that a computer program is pretending to be your dad?
Well, you're a good Walter, either way.
Thank you.
Creeps me out.
It's how she remembers him.
I don't want to get you in trouble.
You learn. I like that.
She's nicer to that thing than she is to me.
It's your father that she's being nicer to. Are you jealous?
Ladies first, as far as introduction, but not necessarily speaking about... This is your film, Michael, right? It's nice to meet you. This is Michael Almereyda, who is the director.
Hello.
Hi. It's a pleasure to meet you, Michael.
Thank you.
And actress Lois Smith, who I've been enjoying on film for a long time and thrilled to meet you. I'm playing it cool, but I've seen many films of yours over the years, and actually, I was wondering, you must also have, and I'm just not aware of it, have you done much theater, too, in your...
Lots, yes, I have.
I just assume so.
I do, yes.
Yeah, is that...
Did and do, yes, and will do. And will do.
And will continue do yes. To the benefit of theatergoers. Where are you, Lois, where are you based?
New York, I live here.
You do?
Yes.
Oh, okay, very good. Yeah. I'm just surprised I have... It would be one of those things where I would be walking up the Upper West Side or Upper East Side, I don't know where you live, but I would have been like... does that happen, by the way?
Oh, yes.
It's such a fan question. I apologize.
Yes.
People, right.
I've been around a long time, so yes, it does.
I guess, but, you know, still, you probably enjoy a certain amount of anonymity, I would assume, too.
Just the right amount.
Just the right, perfect answer. And one other piece of business I want to get out of the way, and that is because I know, Michael, you once directed created a documentary about the actor Sam Shepard. And he did just pass away. And I know growing up in New York, I saw a number of his plays in, you know, as a young adult. And I just didn't know if you had any particular thoughts or memories about it, the loss.
Lois and I were very close with Sam.
Okay.
He wrote one of his last plays for Lois. He wrote a part for Lois.
Is that right?
And that was less than 5 years ago.
Wow.
And I was close enough to him that I'm not inclined to make a little prose poem
superficial
about him
right now. Thing, right?
Yeah, I would recommend though that one thing that we're both proud of is that he had asked me to document rehearsals of a play he was directing in 2000, and it's I'm very happy that we have this document of time, concentrated time with Sam directing actors. It's called This So-Called Disaster. The title came from Sam's. He suggested the title. And it includes Sean Penn, Woody Harrelson, Nick Nolte, Cheech Marin, and a wonderful actress named Sheila Tausi, and Jim Gammon, who was a great stage actor. And the real tribute to Sam is just to read his work, and I don't mind saying looking at that movie, which shows him in action in a very intimate and respectful way.
So you knew each other then... Prior, have you worked together prior to Marjorie Prime?
Yes, we have, just once, a long time ago, but we've been friends for years, Michael and I.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I enjoyed Marjorie Prime very much. And also, I don't know if we'll get to it because Lois is here and I wouldn't want to ignore her by talking about escapes, but I did. I mean, I really, really thought that was...
No, we'll focus it on Lois.
We will. Of course we will. Of course we will.
Thanks.
I will step in it a couple of times here and there. I apologize ahead of time. It's just... I just wanted to make sure I include that. I didn't know when it was coming out, but it was involved. It was a part of the press notes and all that these two films were kind of coming out around the same time. So whoever's listening, put that on your radar. That Escapes is a outstanding documentary about a really unique character. But Marjorie Prime is at hand here, and this is opening actually. Tomorrow here, right, in New York, it's opening
Los Angeles and San Francisco.
Okay, great. And Dixon mentioned as I came in, my friend Dixon over there, that the reviews have so far been very, very kind, so that's good news. So maybe we'll get a lot of people out to see Marjorie.
No, the word isn't kind. The word is sensitive.
Okay. There you are. stars John Hamm and the great... Lois Smith, I understand, is in it. Tim Robbins and Gina Davis, of course. And this was this was a play. Now that I think about it, right? This was a play, and Lois was not in this. She was
a play that I have performed twice.
Oh, okay.
Once before we did the film, and once afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Did you do it? You did it in New York, I assume.
I did.
Mm-hmm. Did you do anywhere else?
Los Angeles.
Okay.
And which theater did you guys work
in? The first production was at the Mark Taper in Los Angeles, and the New York production was Playwrights Horizons.
Okay, great. Yeah. There's still so much great theater going on. My child's mother is in a play right now at Lincoln Center called Pipeline. I don't know if you've heard about it.
I haven't seen it. I've heard about it, yes.
Try to see it's closing soon. That's a little just heads up for people listening. And then I went back and I caught up on a couple of other films of yours finally, so I was glad for the opportunity. Tell me what that experience is like while we're on the subject, that it's an adaptation, I guess. How do you look at that as a filmmaker in this case? Is it any different than adapting somebody else's work, for instance?
About half of my movies have been adaptations, and I just embraced the opportunity to work with material I like, and that
right.
I feel I can join forces with other voices. And it's similar to collaborating with actors. You build on the talents of people who are in the room with you. And I've been lucky. Most of my adaptations have been with writers who aren't alive anymore. Mm-hmm. So they're very...
like William.
They're very open to the collaboration. They don't kick up a fuss about changing the material. But Jordan, I was lucky. He's a young and really gifted playwright who was, after I optioned the play, it was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. So other people liked it too. And it just so happened he wasn't available to do the adaptation. He was writing Orange is the New Black.
Yeah.
And
I blocked it out completely.
And that will... So I managed to put together an adaptation that he liked and that he was sensitive, to use that word. He was very aware of changes and mm-hmm. differences, but he's also open to them and encouraging and ultimately very happy with where we landed. And I don't think of the movie being that different from the play. I think it's very respectful, and it takes the framework and much of his dialogue and the essential ideas and just tries to make it more cinematic. You know, it's that simple.
Do you feel an obligation to honor the stage version? Obviously, the case with Hamlet, for instance, because you updated it.
I felt I was honoring Hamlet too. Mm-hmm. I felt that Shakespeare mm-hmm. would have been at least a little bit intrigued and pleased with what we did.
Mm-hmm.
But the difference with Hamlet is that Hamlet's been adapted so many times that it felt necessary to have fun with it, to make adventurous choices and not to be timid with it. And that's a way of expressing love for material if you really can do a dance with it. But in Jordan's case, maybe I don't want to use the word timid, but mm-hmm. it was more that the work hadn't been revealed to people in the same way, and I was just trying to translate it and be true to it.
Mm-hmm. Lois, have you ever been in a situation where you were in a play and it was adapted before into
no,
a film?
No, I think this is the first one, and mm-hmm. it's been a wonderfully interesting journey from receiving the script, reading to find a theater to do it, mm-hmm. finding one, doing that performance, and then time went by between all of these various manifestations mm-hmm. of the play. But then the film was the next thing, and then just after shooting the film, we did the New York production.
So that's three times she played Marjorie.
Three times, yes.
I guess you did it twice. You did it. You said in New York. And then you did the Los Angeles production, but you also...
L.A. first, and then the movie, and then New York production on stage.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. All right. I didn't get so many notes about it. Otherwise, I would know the answer before I asked the question in some of these cases. But that's an interesting trajectory to experience, I would imagine. But I was wondering, I was always curious when somebody did... When you work with a cast, and I guess... You know, casts change or some of the members change. So this is a typical experience for a stage actor you create a dynamic relationships and then you perform it with maybe new actors on the stage anyway. So maybe the experiencing of doing the film version of this, even though your character is essentially, I assume, the same internally,
yes.
right?
Yes.
But now you're working with different actors playing your...
Yes.
Husband, in this case, because there is a a version of your husband who's in this film.
Yes.
One that is maybe 30 years younger.
Yes. Right.
John.
Why not?
Yes. And then, so is that just, I guess as an actress, that's just something you've learned how to do? And
yes, certainly. And, I mean, it was an unusual situation going from a cast of a play to a different cast in a movie. So it's been, as I say, a unique and interesting journey. I don't think I've ever had this particular journey with a piece of work before. Mm-hmm. I feel very privileged in every part of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like it's do you feel like this is, to some degree, it's kept a certain amount of its that theatricality, even though I don't think anybody who encounters the film version would necessarily think that this had been a play unless if they didn't already know that, you know? So there is a kind of a theatricality to it in the dialogue and in the staging. Yet it has its cinematic.
So, I think so too.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So it would seem like it would translate into something. So it's interesting. You did a New York, the stage version after that you filmed it.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Who was in that version on the New York stage?
Lisa Emery played Tess.
Mm-hmm.
And Stephen Root played John. And Noah Bean played Walter Prime.
Michael, did you set up a rehearsal period in this film? Do you typically work that way?
No, I don't. I don't usually rehearse much. And there's partly out of necessity and partly because it feels comfortable to require actors to be ready and to be primed, as we say. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
So the rehearsal was a luxury we didn't have and maybe one we didn't need, because I felt it was part of the dynamic to throw people into this situation, and there's enough complicity and skill that their reflexes and their abilities serve them well. And but to get back to you almost asked the question. I saw the play, you know, before and after, and it's just further proof of how prismatic a great piece of writing is, that you can have different takes on it, and mm-hmm. different actors bring different things. When my editor, we'd been working on the movie for a while, and we went to see the play in New York, and my editor was shocked. She said, "I didn't know it was a comedy," and because there was a lightness to the play, at least the New York production,
right,
that the movie doesn't quite have. I'd like to think there's an element of fun and it's engaging, and it's, you can laugh a few times at this movie, but the tone is more somber.
Mm-hmm.
And in the play, there was something really snappy about. And it's the same dialogue, the same characters, the
same
scenes.
Right, right.
So it's just it's a different take. And
yeah,
it was fun to recognize that.
I guess the somber comes out of grief and loss. I mean, this is a story about loss.
Ultimately, yes. And Jordan constructed the play so that it does acquire more gravity as it goes. But at the beginning, he had a kind of almost misleading sense of fun. A lot of the jokes I cut out. I just didn't somehow mm-hmm. cotton to them. And and it's also just a matter of the tone, the dynamic that the actors find amongst themselves. I respected that. So, mm-hmm. but it is ultimately, I wouldn't say the movie's just about loss, but it is about the human habit of moving through time in a way where your life can seem like a series of disappearing acts. You lose your sense of identity by degree. You don't have to be old to get that, but you lose your childhood, you lose your adolescence, and simultaneously the people around you are changing.
That's right.
So to project very cleverly, as Jordan does, that in the future we can have holographic embodiments of people who aren't around anymore, it's a very powerful idea, and it brings a lot of associations, a lot of wishful thinking, and it relates to, in a way, to what ghosts are in our lives, hypothetically.
Yeah.
How we're haunted by people who aren't around. If you could actually physicalize that, it's a really great idea. So that excited me, and that's, I hope, that idea is alive and well in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with refrigerator noise.
I know that. I know. It's
just for the excitement of people who aren't here. It's not a flying saucer. It's a refrigerator.
What can you do? Don't worry about it. It's I think it's just automatic, and it goes on for about 30 more seconds if it repeats the last time. We'll put up with it. I often say this is a New York City podcast in the sense that there's a soundtrack. It's usually car horns in the distance, you know, that kind of thing, not motors on, you know, appliances.
And you can also add noises too, right?
Oh, yeah. That's right. But I rarely need to. there is almost, unless I'm forgetting, I don't think you need, there are special effects in this. I don't know. But
the actors are the special effects.
Well said. Were you prepared with that line? Because some people probably ask you about
special effects, but they're very simple.
Yeah, I assume almost every film at this stage uses some special effect or
digital stuff.
Yeah, but point being that one could describe it. Also, there's a way of interpreting this as a science fiction story as well, because of how what you mentioned about the ability to bring holographic
version.
You know, so it's a
sure.
And this could have been written by Philip K. Dick as much as anybody else.
That's a question, I guess. Well,
I didn't really pose it as a question, did I?
But well, it's undeniably a science fiction story.
Yeah,
sure.
Okay, I was hesitant to do that because it's just like most science fictions or good ones that I can recall that are just in a sense a vehicle or what have you, a way of bringing a story to light. But you could remove that and replace it with some other genre too to do the same thing. You know. But I mentioned I went back and I did watch Experimenter finally because it had been on this list I kind of keep. And for whatever reason, I hadn't gotten around to ever seeing it. And I finally got a copy of it and put it on. And I really enjoyed that film.
Thank you.
You seem to be working with some of our best actors.
Why not?
Yeah, well, that's the question. How does that happen? How does it happen? Is it a matter of the quality? Do you think it's are people looking to work with you? Are people asking for you? Are they standing?
I think I'm pretty good at casting, and I tend to go for the best people I can get.
Yeah,
and I'm lucky when they say yes. They're not always easy to reach, but if I can get a script to people, it's, you know, there are barricades, there are agencies,
right,
and agents and managers who are really. You can't blame them. They're interested in money, and that doesn't seem to be my priority these days. So the budgets don't allow these actors to get their usual salaries, but they recognize something in the material that's rewarding in another way. So I've been lucky in that way.
Not to get too far into this subject of budgets because it's a bore, I think it's rude on some level too. But I do wonder how it is for you as someone who seems to be in this blurry spot between budget-wise, without getting into specifics, grappling with a broader distributed films and independent films, which is making dramas or non-superhero, non-big comedies, that type of thing. You're doing something that there aren't a lot of colleagues doing, which are these thoughtful dramas. So I'm wondering how frustrating it is, because you do have to rely, I imagine, on recognizable actors to make it a lot easier for you, correct?
Well, every movie has its own organic life and different necessities, and I like working with actors who happen to be famous because they're usually very strong actors.
Yeah.
And they bring a lot with every part. But I've also worked with unknown actors, and I've done a lot of different kinds of movies. And
yes,
each movie is a kind of miracle within itself, especially if it turns out well. And I'd like to think a lot of my movies do turn out well, but there are always different conditions. And I'm not inclined to complain about how difficult it is, but I think it's common knowledge that making a movie is not simple, not easy.
I guess if we had a lot more time, we could get into that in a more nuanced way. But
we can talk more about Lois. I mean,
Listen.
She is, as you may have heard, a national treasure.
Yes. Be sure to get that in. Yes.
I was going to finish with her for the next 10 minutes.
So. Okay, good.
It may be also a little shyness around Lois.
Did you ever see East of Eden?
Yeah.
Well, she was 19 when she was in that movie. That's her first movie.
I remember, yeah.
And it's worth pointing that out as long as we're talking about Lois Smith.
If I have
And I wrote her an early fan letter. I was there's a performance in Five Easy Pieces where she's Jack Nicholson's sister, and that's a remarkable, enduring performance. And I felt this kind of imaginary connection with her because she's from Kansas, as am I originally. And even if people leave Kansas, I think Kansas never quite leaves them. So I've had a few people in my life, Dennis Hopper, who was in my very first movie, who I think there's a sort of community of Kansans. And it's not necessarily the most conspicuous thing about us, but in my mind, it's an important and essential thing. So you can add this to your list of things to celebrate in Lois.
Kansas
connection.
The Kansas connection. I didn't know Dennis Hopper was from Kansas, too.
Dodge City, yeah.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah. I mean, for a lot of people my age, Lois Smith first came on their awareness, on their radar, with Five Easy Pieces. And it was one of those films my parents loved to quote at home all the time. You know, and it was hard to see for a long time for some reason. So now I
didn't know that.
I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But anyway, so it was probably before the advent of DVDs and everything else, you know, that I'm thinking about, because I was always very curious. And then I watched it like many times once I got my own copy of it. And now it's, of course, one of my favorite films of all time. But Lois, let us end with you, actually. What is it that you still keeps you excited, I guess, about wanting to continue to work and find, I mean, what is it that you look for, I guess, and people send you scripts? Because I imagine you get a fair amount of offers playing the grandmother or whatever, but imagine.
I remember a few years ago beginning to think, uh-oh, are all the scripts going to be dementia, etc.? Sometimes you'd think, actors get asked to do a lot of play readings of new plays, which is, of course, one of the things we do, and it's a proper thing to do. But actually, that isn't what happened. I've been very fortunate to get a series of varied and interesting parts that aren't all. It's a big subject these days, so there are a lot of parts written about. People are writing about their elderly parents.
Yes.
And that's one of the things that happens.
But people must be going to be also interested in the stories about elderly people or whatever, however you want to say. Say again?
Yes, blind psychics. There's one.
Oh, was that one of your recent characters?
Annie Baker's played John a couple of years ago, maybe less than that. But that was one of them. Yes.
Is there theater in your near future? Is there a play that's
I'm going to do a couple of plays. They're not very soon. One is next spring. The new group is doing a new play called Peace for Mary Frances, which I will do.
Uh-huh. And here in New York, it sounds like.
Yes, here in New York.
Wonderful.
The new group uses the Signature Theater as their space, and that's where I'll do it. I've done a lot of things there. And after that, I'm going to do a new Craig Lucas play at Playwrights Horizons called I Was Most Alive With You. I'm looking forward to both of those.
Or do you have associations with these particular group, like theater groups in general?
I've repeatedly performed at both of those theaters, and I guess that becomes, yes, it becomes a precious association, yeah.
I mean, this is a ridiculous question as it comes out of my mouth, I guess, but Broadway, that's not the goal.
I haven't done a Broadway play for quite a while. Quite a number. My first job in the world as a professional was a Broadway play that ran all season. That was in 1952. My first job. Melvin Douglas was my father.
I've heard of him. What year did you get cast in East of Eden?
55, I think.
Wow. Yeah. Maybe it was based on your good work in that play then.
Probably not. I think it was separate. But I was fortunate to start when I first came to the city to work in theater and film and television, of which there was lots.
A lot of live stuff too, right?
The first ones I did were
Playhouse 90 and all that type of...
Yeah.
It's an exciting time.
It was an exciting time.
Yeah.
And because I was able to start right away in all the media, I have been able to make a living as an actor all these decades, which is a great piece of good fortune.
It is a great fortune, not just for you, but for the rest of us, too.
Oh, thank you.
And Michael, by the way. Okay. Well, in my postscript, because I haven't been chased away, and I know that I will be shortly, and I got to get back to my own child, but I'm going to come back to Escapes because it is about a great actor as well. Somebody who maybe your paths crossed with
Hampton Fancher.
Hampton Fancher.
Michael has introduced me to him. I think I've met him twice.
Okay.
We did not.
Well, yeah, but maybe their paths crossed anyway because I don't know. What is the plan for that? If you in fact know, I don't know. Maybe.
You missed that. It came out at the IFC a few weeks ago.
I did miss it completely then.
It ran for 2 weeks, but it's opening.
I apologize.
It's opening in San Francisco this week.
Okay.
It's got a life of 15 different cities.
Son of a bitch.
The Landmark chain has promoted it, and it'll be on VOD before you know it because it's going to correspond with the release of Blade Runner because this fellow wrote
Blade Runner. And Blade Runner 2, the next one, 2000, whatever the year
49.
Is. 49, I know. Yeah, but it's a
very significant year, apparently. 2049.
Well, it's just part of Harrison Ford's reprising every franchise as an old man, and God bless him for doing it. I'm sorry, that's very unusual where I would totally miss something like that. Usually it somehow
I'm
makes
I'm glad you saw and liked the movie.
I loved it.
We can continue to promote it into infinity.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be in San Francisco. We're going to put the show up in a couple of days, so we'll tell people out.
Great.
People in San Francisco to go check out this documentary. Maybe it's set the Castro, I don't know, but...
at the Roxy.
Thank you. It's too bad. I would love to have gotten Hampton also on. It would have been how did I not know about this guy? You know, so it was a really terrific documentary.
Thank you again.
So 2 for 2, Marjorie Prime opening in New York and L.A. by the time you hear this, actually, because it's going to be Friday,
and
August
18th.
In San Francisco. San Francisco. And Escapes is already in San Francisco. And if you're in New York, sorry, you missed it. We'll figure it out. I'm sure it'll be available on other platforms at some point soon enough. But thank you, Lois, very much. It was a real pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you for putting up with our one microphone here. And thank you, Michael, so much and putting up with all the...
Thanks again. Yeah. So long.
Okay, you bet. Thank you, everybody. We'll be back in just a couple of days with another episode. This Thursday, we'll be posting a new episode of Filmwax Radio. Coming up on the show is a conversation with documentary filmmakers Doug Block and Michael Rosato Bennett. We have an episode coming up with Eric Schaefer, a local Brooklyn filmmaker who's one of the more talented people I know, named Monahan. He's been on the show before. And then local Brooklyn-based actor Matt Mayer, who's an old friend of mine, and Betty Gordon, who is one of the great filmmakers originally from the downtown No Wave Underground here in New York City. She'll be on the show. Much more coming up in the next few weeks. Thank you for listening. This has been episode number 422 of Filmwax Radio. I'm your host, Adam Shartoff. Okay, please do continue to take care of yourself and the ones you love. Until next time. Broken lines, broken strings.